back together again, you and I, midweek Wednesday style, June 21st to 2023 on Connecticut Today. We welcomed Wallingford Republican State Rep. Craig Fischbein back to the program to chat about the latest state report on gun crime prosecutions. We also heard from foreign policy expert Sean Mirsky, author of We May Dominate the World, Ambition, Anxiety, and the Rise of the American Colossus. Taking a look at a new report that came out with a lot of interesting and deep numbers as to what the state does, doesn't do, and maybe could do more better and efficiently is to gun crimes. What the state does prosecution-wise, it's always been a big talking point. Let's get a perspective on that from a gentleman at the state capitol who knows a lot about firearms, firearm laws in the state, the general laws. State Rep. Craig Fischbein, Republican Wallingford and Middlefield. He's also the ranking member on the General Assembly's Judiciary Committee. Mr. Fischbein, how are you, sir? Long time. How you doing?
Hey, Paul. Well, yeah, long time no see, no talk. How are you?
I'm good, Craig. It's all good here. Living the dream, and, you know, you're a fine lawyer, and I get up every morning and say, well, it's too late for law school, so I'll just keep doing this. And
I just wanted to know how many different Quinnipiac Champion T-shirts and or sweatshirts you've purchased in the last 2 months.
There's a couple hanging around, but, you know, we may have to talk about that on the side. You know, when I see Coach, I'll see if he can lose a couple of more, but that's another deal. New report, Craig, that came out, and a lot of people read it one way, a lot of people read it the other way. Tell my listeners what's going on here as far as gun crimes and some stuff that they may or may not know.
Well, it's ironic. You know, I guess last week Hunter Biden's advance team came to Connecticut and is heralding all these gun laws, and when we look at these stats, we're seeing that some of the gun laws that are presently on the books are not being prosecuted. You know, one of the areas that we recently tamped down on is the what's known as the bulk purchase of handguns. Mm-hmm. Currently under Connecticut law, passed or signed by the governor a couple weeks ago, you can't purchase more than three handguns in a 30-day period. And I had asked when we were talking about that why, and they said to try and prevent what are known as straw purchases, and that's where somebody buys a gun on paper for themselves, mm-hmm. but is ostensibly buying it to sell to someone else. And, you know, I look at, and that's 2937JA, these stats bear out that hardly anybody has been arrested for purchasing a firearm for transfer to a prohibited person. So just that one jumps off the page at me. Just looking at, in 2019, one person was arrested for doing that in Connecticut, and that case was nollied. There was no prosecution. And in 2021, one person, again, arrested, and that case was nollied also. Just going back to 2018, one person was arrested for doing that, and that case was dismissed. So, you know, that's helpful in proving, I guess, a portion of the new gun laws are just about politics and not about good public policy. I mean, there's other aspects, you know, in here. Carrying a pistol or a revolver without a permit. So you are required to have your permit on you when you carry.
Okay.
And in 2022,
yeah,
218 people were found guilty. Of the 648 people that were arrested, but 378 of those were actually nollied. So almost double. In fact, if you take the dismissals and the nollies and add them up together and compare them to the guilties, that's about a 50% rate. Now, those are people that don't have permits. So they're either in criminal possession of a firearm
already,
because
yeah,
they are a prohibited
yeah.
person. Yeah. Or they haven't gone through the process to get a permit, and therefore more than likely they have illegally acquired that handgun. So you have a lot of little boxes to check off there.
Yeah.
Half of those pit cases are not getting prosecuted.
Wow. Big number there. State Rep. Craig Fischbein is back with us on the line, Republican representing parts of Wallingford and Middlefield. So, Craig, let's talk about this report that came out. Go back to this now. When you say a case is nollied, I guess most people kind of understand that. Now, some people have come out, and Craig, and said, well, we nolly some of these charges to get convictions on other stuff, Craig, with which I guess may be the case, but you know the old phrase, perception is reality, and while the judicial system may have its reasons for doing this, Craig, you know, the common person sees these numbers and asks, you know, well, what's going on? What are your views on these numbers? Oh, Craig, hang on, let me punch you up again. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, no problem. So, you know, you hear on one hand that we want in Connecticut to address the rampant gun crime that's in our cities. Mm-hmm. And certainly through legislation, one can prioritize cases. We do that with family violence crimes.
Sure.
You know, we say that those cases are going to get priority. But here, the numbers bear out that with no prosecution at all, they aren't taking precedent, you know. So just for your listeners, you know, a nolly basically is a dismissal. The case is left open for 13 months, and assuming that the accused doesn't do anything within that 13 months that would give rise to another arrest, the case is dismissed. There is no minimum number of nollies. A lot of people don't know that. You could mm-hmm. go to court, you know, every day of the week, and prosecutor is discretionary on whether or not to enter a nolly. And except in one case, I saw a judge once bristle at a nolly being entered. But even in that case, the nolly did get accepted by the court. So, you know, there has to be a strong message on both sides. You know, the rhetoric is not, you know, certainly down in Bridgeport, we see the problems. Hartford, we read about it every day. And until we take these cases seriously, I think you're going to continue to see the problems.
And speaking of Bridgeport, Craig, with Mayor Ganim and Waterbury, with Mayor O'Leary, you mentioned Hartford, Mayor Bronin, and New Haven Mayor Elliger. You know, all four of those mayors went up to or over to the Capitol months ago and told you folks in the General Assembly, said, hey, we've got to get tougher here on a relatively small subset of repeat bad guys and bad girls, the repeat violent gun offenders here. Whatever happened with that? Was anything, Craig, actually passed on that? Have we tightened things up, or did we do something preliminary? What's the update on that?
So a portion of what the mayors had proposed did get passed into law. It got significantly watered down. What it dealt with is repeat gun crime offenders.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But, you know, I'm going to tell you, and I brought this up a lot of times during session, the problem is those people that want to lawfully traverse the very onerous system that we have are being stopped at the door in many of our cities. You know, call one of these police departments today and ask them, say, I want to come down and file for a pistol permit. And they'll tell you, you can't come down for about 6 months just to apply. And then they're sitting on the applications for 6, 7, 8 months. In fact, as part of the new law that got passed a few weeks ago, we allowed residents starting October 1st to just circumvent the towns, because they are creating so many problems. So when people are fearful of illegal guns in the cities and they want to lawfully follow the process, but the process is being stymied by government, those people that are fearful are having to turn to illegal guns. It's a circle.
So, and that's interesting, Craig. So that in and of itself, I just want to make sure people understand what you're saying. There are people who so desperately want a gun for whatever reason. We can't get into their heads. They're fearful, like you say, whatever. And I've heard that they will basically say, well, you know what? This guy's after me, or I live in a bad neighborhood. I'm going to go the illegal route. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, in fact, Senator Winfield, who happens to be one of the chairs of the Judiciary Committee, he said as much during the public hearing when Mayor Bronin came and was pushing for this legislation. You know, Senator Winfield generally said that people in his community need illegal guns to protect themselves.
I remember when he said that, Craig, and I was like, really? Wow.
And that's the reason why, is because the system has become so onerous. So, you know, to the governor's credit, a portion of the bill does allow, as I said, applications that are submitted October 1 through March 31st of 2024, if the town does not expressly deny within 32 weeks, which is a lot of time to begin with.
You can go
right to the state police. You swear to an affidavit that you submitted and they hadn't denied. And then starting after April 1 of next year, that comes down to 16 weeks. So, you know, the legislature is saying to the towns, get your act together, because these people want to be able to exercise their rights and you're creating a problem.
Interesting that you say that's fostering some illegal guns. Craig, finally, what about the notion that you had also those mayors and other chiefs of police around the state saying, hey, we've got to change the state statutes on, you know, the mandatory, as some level of bail or bond has to be set for even the most violent people. Did that change or not?
No, unfortunately, there was very, very heavy lobbying by the bail bondsman.
Really?
During the session. A portion of what the mayor's proposed, the 30% bail, did get codified into law. Mm-hmm. However, as you may have heard or read, the judicial branch, the judges got together and they created a practice book change having to do with bail, which runs somewhat in conflict with that. So that's a whole constitutional crisis sort of issue. But we need wholesale change on the bail front. We need our Constitution to be amended to permit individuals to be held without bail. We don't have that provision right
now.
Our Constitution says that everybody's entitled to bail. So that means if Adam Lanza had survived that situation, he would have been out. And our Supreme Court has said that bail can't be too high as to be punitive. So when people say, well, you put a $50 million bail on, no, that's unconstitutional.
Yeah.
Our courts have already spoken. So,
yeah. Craig, thank you. Be good. We'll chat. State Rep. Craig Fishbein, Republican, Wallingford Middlefield, ranking member on Judiciary. And as you know, Craig by now from all of his appearances here knows the gun laws and knows all the machinations of such and who knows what and who says what up in Hartford on all this. Craig, thanks, and maybe I'll run into you in the middle of town.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Paul.
Take care. Day. Craig Fishbein right there on WICC. Yeah, how about that, folks? We'll get back to something. Did you know that about the bail bond system and the bail bondsman? They didn't want to lose any business. Folks, you know I love American history, foreign policy stuff. I really get into it, and I believe we still have to continue learning about the country, learning about where we came from. Our next guest has a great new book out. He's a lawyer and U.S. foreign policy scholar. He's worked on national security issues across multiple presidential administrations. He's a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, currently practices national security, foreign relations, and appellate law at Arnold and Porter K. Schooler, LLP. He's a visiting scholar at the Hoover Institution. He's worked for Democratic and Republican administrations. Sean Mirsky is the guest. Name of the book, We May Dominate the World, Ambition, Anxiety, and the Rise of the American Colossus. Sean, hi, it's Paul here at WICC. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Very, very well. Thank you, Sean. Appreciate it. Man, I love this sort of stuff. And you tell here in the book, right, how America became this colossus, a superpower. I mean, everybody looks at the country that today, Sean, and they think, oh, we were always this way. No, we weren't, correct?
That's exactly right. I think most Americans are sort of used to the post-World War II understanding of the United States as a global superpower with this unassailable position in the Western Hemisphere. And what my book does is it sort of tells the story of how we got there, particularly in the years since the Civil War all the way up to the dawn of the Cold War.
So what happened? What were the first couple of, Sean, major occurrences post-Civil War that you can point to or people should look at and say, okay, we had some indications here?
Yeah, well, so one of the big, one of the opening chapters of the book deals with the Civil War itself, where I think most listeners might not appreciate this, but during the Civil War, Europe's great powers really took advantage of what was going on in the United States to try and expand back into the Western Hemisphere. And so this really culminated with France invading and occupying all of Mexico during that era. And so right after the Civil War finishes, we have this just incredible moment in American history where General Grant sends down General Sheridan and 50,000 Union soldiers. And 3 months after the end of the Civil War, the most devastating conflict in American history, the United States is gearing up to go to war with France in Mexico to kick France out. And it's the start of my book because I think it just sort of illustrates just how perilous our situation was at that particular moment in history.
Foreign policy expert, legal scholar Sean Mirsky joins us. We may dominate the world, ambition, anxiety, and the rise of the American colossus. It comes out in a few days. Check it out, Amazon.com, wherever you get your books, Barnes & Noble, your local store. It's in hardcover, Kindle version, audiobook as well. So Sean, post the Civil War, you know, you mentioned France. Was France a part of Europe with those other folks there that said, hey, we better keep this America thing in check here? Was there an active notion that, you know, they're vulnerable here, let's put our boot on them now while we can, or not?
That was absolutely the idea. At the time, both France and other powers like Great Britain were really worried about the rise of the United States, and they sort of saw the Civil War as an opportunity to check us. And that was, I think, a trend that kind of continued for the next few decades, and Germany got in on the act as well. The problem was each of these powers were, at the end of the day, more concerned about events in Europe than they were in the Americas. And so they were never really able to get their act together and kind of contain us in a systematic way.
So were they worried about American colonialism, like, hey, they're going to come trotting on our soil or not?
So less that and more just that the United States would continue to grow and potentially, I guess, colonialism in the sense that we would annex, you know, the rest of Mexico
yeah.
and start moving south. But really, I think it was a combination of an economic and security threat that because we were the only great power in the Americas, that if somebody didn't stop us, we would eventually reach the point where we could just use the Western Hemisphere as a springboard to start intervening in Europe and Asia, which, of course, is exactly what happened.
If you had a name, one or two folks that you cite in the book, Sean, that my audience may, you know, react to and say, oh, yeah, who might be the one or two people that were the really major driving forces here as America, emerged from the Civil War to become a superpower?
So the heart of the book really covers the period from like 1898 to 1918.
Mm-hmm.
And so, of course, one of the most prominent characters is Theodore Roosevelt, who, you know, with his exuberance and enthusiasm and witty sayings, it's impossible not to find him fascinating. So he's obviously pretty prominent in the book. A lot of the other American leaders of the time, like Woodrow Wilson and Taft, are also make appearances. But the book also covers, some lesser-known characters, some ne'er-do-wells, including some banana company kings and some hired guns who were working in Central American wars at the time, and just a really fascinating mix of people.
America, even back then, we're grown to over 350 million people now. But even back then, Sean Mirsky, America's a big chunk of land there as we emerged from the Civil War into the early 1900s. How did the country stay together? And were there regions of the U.S. that did not want to be this overbearing superpower or not?
So the Civil War itself, I think, settled, you know, obviously one of the biggest kind of questions, geographical questions inside the United States. But in a lot of ways, I think after the Civil War, there was more of a consensus on U.S. foreign policy than there was before, because before the Civil War, the South was pushing for expansion into Latin America because they wanted new slave states into the in the Union, whereas the North, for the most part, was opposed. But coming out of the Civil War, and especially kind of into the early 20th century, we had a period where I think Americans were, by and large, on the same page. Although it was a very uncomfortable page because Americans, on the whole, did not want to be dominating, you know, their neighbors to the south. But for various reasons, largely relating to the country's defense and sort of security concerns, they found themselves in a position where they thought that was the best move to make.
When we look at what's happening today, Sean, with Russia and with Iran and with China, I would guess particularly with China, any parallels to what went on post-Civil War in the U.S.?
So many. I mean, and part of the reason I wrote this book was to reflect on how great powers today act and see how it compares to the United States. I mean, one of the easiest parallels to draw is simply that great powers always want to carve out a sphere of influence. They always want to make sure that they, in their immediate neighborhood, they are preeminent and that they have certain privileges and protections that may not be afforded to other powers. And so you see that with Russia and Ukraine, and you certainly see that with China and East Asia, where China's, you know, doing its level best essentially to expel the United States because it helps guarantee its own security.
But it's interesting, Sean, and I'm sure you've thought about this with your vast foreign policy background. They want to expel us from the area, but without us, their economy takes a major hit. I mean, sometimes I don't get it, Sean, but that's just me being the dopey talk show host here. But isn't that kind of a strange, like, why are you waving a gun at your best customer, right? I don't get that.
It's a difficult balance for the Chinese to strike because so much of their success economically has been dependent on their integration into this U.S.-led international order, and particularly the economic components. I think in the ideal world, the Chinese would continue growing within the confines of that economic order, but what they really want is to eliminate the U.S. military presence in East Asia. So, for instance, they want a lot less bases off the Chinese coast. They want a lot less U.S. troops in the area.
Sure.
And they want a lot fewer U.S. alliances with their immediate neighbors.
Now, long before the Russian invasion of Ukraine, and of course you have geopolitical stuff there going back hundreds of years, I remember, Sean, seeing an interview with Vladimir Putin, must have been about 4 or 5 years ago. And I think he sat down with Charlie Rose. It was a great, great interview as far as trying to get in Putin's mind here. But, you know, he, I guess, is opining for the old Soviet Union. And one thing that kind of hit me in there, Sean, and maybe it puts all this in focus better for people trying to figure this out. He basically said, I want Russia to matter. Is that what fuels him and what's going on right now, that post the old Soviet Union, other than, you know, natural gas and oil, there's not a lot going on with Russia?
Yeah, so I mean, a lot of people joke that at this point, Russia is a gas station with nuclear weapons. And there's certainly a truth to that. And I think, you know, Putin, like other leaders, wants his nation to be great and wants his nation to be kind of respected on the international scene. But at the same time, you know, I do think that there's probably also security concerns underlying, you know, much of what he and the Russian military establishment feel. And so, you know, Russia has been opposed to NATO enlargement since the, since the early 90s. And while I think it's too soon to say how much that particular concern drove the invasion of Ukraine, it's hard to believe that it didn't matter at least a little bit.
Sean, finally, before we wrap this up, fast forward, if you can, I'll give you 5 years. Fast forward to probably, you know, just beyond the next presidential election, maybe a second election. Where do we stand? What do you think the world in 5 years is going to look like, particularly vis-a-vis U.S., China, Russia, Iran, North Korea? What do you think?
So I wish I could be more optimistic, but I think the answer is that the world is going to be in a much more competitive place, with a lot of these great powers acting potentially much more aggressively than they are even today in order to protect their interests. And so looking ahead to that world, I think it's imperative for Americans to realize that in a lot of ways, the last few decades has been a holiday from the great power competition that characterizes most of human history. And we unfortunately might be slipping back into that, and it's necessary to prepare accordingly.
And it really is, Sean, tough to get Americans to care about foreign policy, isn't it?
It can be, but at the end of the day, you know, these big questions, the kind of relationships between these great powers, in some ways matter more than almost anything else in determining the course of kind of day-to-day history. And you see that, for instance, even now with Russia's invasion of Ukraine, it's affecting fuel prices, the price of, you know, food across the world. And that's like a relatively minor, you know, kind of change in the international scene. Some of these bigger, you know, wars that you see between great powers themselves, like World War One, World War Two, I mean, really have ramifications that, you know, go very deep and stretch for many decades.
Sean, thank you. We May Dominate the World, Ambition, Anxiety, and the Rise of the American Colossus. The guest has been Sean Mirsky. Sean, thank you. Appreciate it. And hopefully we can chat down the road. Good luck.
Thank you for having me on.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Folks, pick it up if you're like me and you're like a foreign policy, world affairs geek. We May Dominate the World, Ambition, Anxiety, and the Rise of the American Colossus starts post-Civil War. How did America get so big? Guns, butter, a little of both? Sean, thank you.